Welcome to another episode of Workings of the Townships on CJMQ 88.9 FM. This is your host, Shelby. And today we are going to explore some questions about Canada's economy, such as why doesn't all regions within Canada develop at the same pace? Why are there richer provinces and poorer provinces? Why can't we all have the same prosperity and live out the virtues of economic egalitarianism? Well, popular demand and political will are only a few causes for growth and disparities amongst locales. So each province's economic development has been determined by many things, such as location, its access to farmland and wild game, which was especially important in the early days of Canada, since food wasn't as accessible as it is today. Also, it is necessary to recognize the type of resources that are available within an area, the province's transportation system, and access to waterways, its proximity to the United States borders or tidewater for trading purposes. Also, its level of modern infrastructure and technology to help extract resources. History, foreign investment, government policies, human capital, and the status of industrial ownership are also very important when understanding the current economic positions of each region. There is a lot to be said about them, but I will be focusing more on the geopolitical elements that determine its state in the economy. This show will touch on degrees of development in each region when it comes to its natural resources, infrastructure, waterways, and accessibility to markets. So, let's start off with the cold, sparsely populated hinterlands of the territories, which includes the Yukon, Northwest Territories, and Nunavut. And when combined, these areas make up 40% of the landmass in Canada, but only contains a small percentage of the country's population. For example, there are more people in PEI, that small little tiny island, than there is in all of the territories. When it comes to natural resources, the territories are gifted in petroleum and in metals. Most attention has been given to the Beaufort Sea and the Mackenzie Delta. For instance, it is estimated that the Northwest Territories alone could hold as much as 37% of Canada's marketable light crude oil and about 35% of its marketable natural gas resources. They are also blessed with minerals and base metals such as gold, iron, and diamonds. A lot of these resources are marked as potential, which is thought to exist, or conditional, which is known to exist. But things like economic feasibility and a lack of infrastructure hinders them from being marketable. As you can imagine, infrastructure there isn't as well developed as other parts of Canada. A low population, high building costs, logistic challenges, and political will can attribute to the reasons as to why infrastructure is limited. This makes the transportation of people and resources difficult. The Mackenzie River, which is the second largest river in North America, second to the Mississippi River, is frozen most of the year, making it an unreliable shipping route. Also, the Arctic Ocean, with its unpredictable storms and dangerous icebergs, can be difficult to navigate. These factors limit market accessibility. But in 2017, the Tuktoyaktuk Highway was completed. It was the first all-weather road to reach Canada's Arctic coast. It allows isolated communities to have more access to the outside world, and the outside world to have more access to their world. And when it comes to human capital, the Yukon, along with many other places in Canada, are struggling with labor shortages. To deal with this, in 2019, the Yukon government signed an agreement with the Filipino government to hire as many as 2,000 Filipino nurses and skilled workers every year to try to mitigate the problem. I can only imagine the shock that some of these people may experience when transitioning to a tropical climate to a subarctic one. Now, let's move on to the Western Canada region. So this region combines British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. When the population of these four provinces are combined, they still are a couple million short of matching Ontario's population of 14 million people, the largest in Canada. The western provinces contribute to about 35% of Canada's GDP. These provinces all have a unique geological makeup that determines their economic development. So starting with British Columbia, it is a province that reaps the benefits of being on the coast of the Pacific Ocean and housing the biggest port in Canada, Port Vancouver. It also capitalizes on its vast amounts of resources, such as forestry, coal, gas, and hydro. It has the biggest financial center in Western Canada. Second to that is Calgary. Alberta is known for its fossil fuel resources, the biggest in Canada, and has attracted heavy investment, especially in the oil sands. During its boom cycle, it attracts people from all over Canada and the world who go there to take advantage of its employment opportunities. One of the biggest challenges that they face is their limited transportation systems for their oil. Since it is a landlocked province, it has troubles getting their product to Tidewater. This limits their market. The majority of their oil is sold to America at discount prices. And at one point during the current recession, Albertan oil was being sold at a lower price than Coca-Cola. Hence why the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion has been such a source of controversy. The TMX is set to increase the capacity of oil sent to Tidewater by adding another pipeline alongside the pre-existing one. So let's mosey on over to good old Saskatchewan. Now, Saskatchewan is also endowed with resources. It has things like petroleum, uranium. It is also known as the breadbasket of the world and the largest producer of grains and oil seeds in Canada. Also, very important, Saskatchewan isn't just a pretty face. It is the largest producer of potash, which is used mainly as fertilizer. And like Alberta, it is a landlocked province. It is about 1,400 kilometers away from the nearest port, which is a serious problem for a province that produces so many exports. Its transportation system relies on rail and trucks to get their product to market. Any blockades on the rails or the road can have significant economic repercussions. And then also we got Manitoba. Manitoba has forestry, minerals, and good quality agriculture, and produces about 97% of its electricity through hydropower. It is not landlocked, since some of the northeast borders line the James Bay, but does not have direct access to major maritime shipping routes. Now, let's skip over to the Atlantic provinces, which, as you know, consists of Newfoundland, Prince Edward Island, New Brunswick, and Nova Scotia. They contribute to about 6% of Canada's GDP. Despite the 1992 moratorium on northern cod fishing, which resulted to Canada's largest industrial layoffs, fishing and fish processing still account for a large part of their economy. But over the past decades, the economic climate has changed. For example, Newfoundland, once considered the weakest province in this region, has now become the strongest. They now contribute to national equalization payments instead of receiving them. Their transition is thanks to their access to minerals, hydroelectric power, and offshore oil. These Atlantic provinces, as I'm sure you're well aware of, has access to the great, the wonderful Atlantic Ocean. So why hasn't success been granted to all of these provinces? Well, a maritime transportation route is important, but it's not the only thing that grows the economy. One reason for economic struggle in the Atlantic provinces is due to the lack of population growth. Now, it is easy to find lovely people there, but very difficult to find a job, which gives little incentives for people to move there, and a lot of incentive for people to move out. Now, Ontario. If you look at Ontario, well, Ontario has truly got it going on. It contributes to 40% of Canada's overall GDP. It's got resources, it's got manufacturing capabilities, it's got the location, not to mention a long history, government headquarters, and it makes up about 39% of the country's overall population. It has many mining operations and ranks third in agriculture behind Saskatchewan and Alberta. Much of Canada's manufacturing sector is located here, yet it continues to shift to the service sector, which contributes to about 3/4 of Ontario's GDP, while manufacturing only adds about 1/4 to its GDP. Its success has a lot to do with its geological location, its close proximity to America, and waterways like the St. Lawrence Seaway, which makes it easier to get its products to international markets. It also has two important cities, Ottawa, which is the national capital and has a strong public sector employment, and Toronto, which is a global financial capital. And last but not least, we have Quebec. Quebec is also bumping. It has the second largest economy in Canada, and if Quebec was a country, its economy would be ranked the 44th largest in the world. Not too bad. Yet, it is still considered to be a have-not province, so it receives transfer payments that have been contributed to by other provinces that are seen as better off, so the have provinces. And in 2019, out of the $19 billion in equalization funds, Quebec took about $13 billion of that to put towards their cultural, healthcare, and education programs. So a lot of people are left wondering why they get so much money when they have so much going on for them. Quebec is one of the most affordable provinces in Canada. It has a big manufacturing, hydro, and service sector. It also has the second largest city in Canada, which is a center for commerce, industry, and technology. It borders America and has easy access to the Atlantic Ocean for trading. So, if Newfoundland can rise from a have-not province to a have-province, I hope Quebec can too. You can do it. But Quebec has faced some challenges when it comes to its economic growth. It used to hold the coveted economic status that Ontario has now, but in the mid-20th century, it started to decline. There are three main reasons why this happened. First was the completion of the St. Lawrence Seaway, which was completed in the 1950s. It is a string of channels that link the Great Lakes to the St. Lawrence River. Once that was built, ships could bypass the Montreal port, which reduced its importance. Secondly was political instability, which was associated to the October Crisis and the two referendums, one in 1980 and the other in 1995. So during the October Crisis in 1970, the Front de Libération du Québec, or the FLQ, kidnapped two government officials. One was released, the other was murdered. The Prime Minister, Pierre Trudeau, evoked the only peacetime use of War Measures Act in Canada. The FLQ demanded for a socialist insurrection against oppressors identified as the Anglo-Saxon imperialism, and the overthrow of the Quebec government, the independence of Quebec from Canada, and the establishment of a French-speaking Quebecois workers' society. During the crisis, support was gained from many left-leaning students, teachers, and academics who engaged in public strikes in solidarity for the FLQ. Makes you wonder about the quality of critical thinking in academia. Then, in 1980, the PQ called for the first provincial-wide referendum. The proposed separation was defeated by 60 to 40%. Again, in 1995, another referendum was held. This was much closer, yet it was rejected by voters with 50.6 saying no and 49.4 saying yes. And the third reason for Quebec economic depression was a French-only language law passed in 1974. So all of these things, to their own respective degree, impacted the economy by creating instability. These events reduced incentives for international businesses to locate in the province, and in turn, business moved to places that were more secure. So folks, there you have it. A brief summary of Canada's regional economic climate. There is a lot of things that act as determining factors on how well a region performs, and here we just scrape the surface. So I'll leave you with a song now, and when I was picking out this week's song, I thought I'd pick Wheat Kings. I picked it at first because, it had wheat in the title, and then you got wheat, farming, resource, economy. It just all fit together. But when I read about the song, what it was really about, I realized that it has nothing to do with farming. Instead, it is a sad story about how David Milgaard, a man who served 23 years in prison for a crime he did not commit. In Saskatchewan, Milgaard was convicted of raping and murdering a woman named Gail Miller when he was just 16 and was sentenced to life in prison. The case was based off flimsy evidence and shoddy police work. It is a sad tale, but I hope you can appreciate the artistic genius of one of the greatest bands that ever came out of Canada. Here's Wheat Kings by The Tragically Hip.
Sundown in the Paris of the prairie, we kings of all treasures buried. And all you hear are the rusty breezes pushing around the weather vane Jesus. Zippo lighter, he sees the killer's face. Maybe it's someone standing in a killer's place. 20 years for nothing, well, that's nothing new. Besides, no one's interested in something you didn't do. We can't. Let's just see what the morning brings. There's a dream he dreams where the high school's dead and start. It's a museum and we're all locked up in it after dark. Walls are lined all yellow, gray, and sinister, hung with pictures of our parents, prime ministers. We kings and pretty things. Late breaking story on the CBC. A nation whispers we always knew that he'd go free. They add you can't be fond of living in the past. 'Cause if you are, then there's no way that you're gonna last. We pretty things.